The confusion matrix.
Yes, indeed. We are rolling yet again. Hello, Pete. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm still down south, but I think you're back up in the northern parts.
I am in not sunny Scotland, where it is not sunny. But I'm always glad to be back because there are far fewer people here.
And more animals.
Yes, there are more animals. I once got faced down by an angry sheep who wouldn't let me pass him. It was quite genuinely scary because he had horns and everything.
Oh, right.
And, I assume it was a he. I think he was defending his patch or something. I could imagine that thing could do some serious damage. Yeah. So there are dangers to lurking around in the countryside in central rural Scotland.
Most definitely.
You heard it here, folks. You know, come armed if you come at all. Right. I'm going to have a little bit of a moment at the beginning of this, and then we're going to talk about some stuff that's good. First things first, I have a new keyboard, right? Sitting in front of me. It arrived like 5 minutes ago, right? and I'm so pleased. I've got a new keyboard because I've been meaning to get one for ages. And I want to get an Ergo keyboard because I think it's the right thing to do. And also now I've damaged my thumb, which I'll come back to at some point. That I need to sort of rethink how I'm using my hands for typing. So I've got one of these split Ergo keyboards, and it's a mechanical one. Specifically, it's the EpoMaker Split 65. And after researching extensively on split keyboards, I last night in a slightly unsober fit of purchasing, just went on Amazon and picked one, right? That I'd not even been part of my research.
Oh, no.
So this is either going to be some form of brilliance or a complete fail. But it's really heavy and the box is really nice. And so I think, you know, at least some of this expense is worth it just for the pleasure of unboxing it. And this is a really nice bit of kit. Can you hear the keys? They're kind of satisfyingly crunchy, but not too loud, right? Oh, and it's got a little knob on it that does little clickies. Oh, it clicks and clicks around. I can get really, really excited by little clicky knobs, right? And nice feeling keys. I used to get obsessed by pause keys on tape players when I was a kid. I think it's an autism thing. Anyway, there you go. So this is not really good podcast fodder. I just wanted to gloat about my new mechanical keyboard. And you people, in your insolence, are keeping me from plugging in and playing with it and doing all the typing. So that's my first thing for the day. Any questions?
Well, I just thought we were going to be on a live clack and swear as it's all in different places and you keep hitting the wrong key. So fortunately, you're talking rather than typing, and we'll let you come back in a week with your reporting of how many missed keys you made.
Honestly, it's probably going to drive me nuts, right? But then the current situation is also driving me nuts, and this is infinitely customizable, and I can even take the keys off and put my own ones on, and I can remap things. It's a 65% one, though, so I haven't got that much to remap, which already seems to me a little bit of a fail. But they come with layers, so you can hit a key and then it just remaps for whatever task it is you're doing. I had my son look into building keyboards, custom keyboards, which he spent days doing and going, I never realized how complicated this is. This is bonkers. And he's smart and he had a job for a while building PCs, gaming PCs. He knows his stuff, and he was like, keyboards are crazy and people get really nuts about them, right? and exactly the noise that they make and the travel of the keys and the particular type of switches you have to have, and then you have to solder them together and everything. And I was like, well, mate, go on then, do it. And he's like, no, Dad, so I was gonna have to buy one pre-made. So I did. I think probably we could invite Joe on and could do a whole episode on keyboards, but Is that good podcasting? I don't know. Listeners, write in and with your requests if you want us to do that. And so that's that. And the next thing I'm going to do, my thing to bring to the tables today, is a list of complaints.
Okay.
Because I feel like complaining, and because I'm allowed to. And this is my podcast as well as yours, obviously. But, you know, I'm having my moment, and my moment is going to be to complain, right? But right. I do realise that this isn't necessarily what everyone wants to hear. So I'm going to keep it to an absolute minimum, and I'm going to time myself on my little timer on my phone, right? I'm going to time myself 5 minutes of complaining, and I have a list in front of me. It could take 30 seconds. I could get cut off on point number two. I don't know. We'll have to see how we get on. Okay?
Right.
Are you ready for this?
Yes. Click the timer.
Right. 3, 2, 1, go. Number one on my list. My office is messy. I have a home office. It is a complete state. I tidied it up. It feels like about a week ago, and it's a complete mess again. Cluttered artworks, bits of vinyl records out of their sleeve, piles of books that have toppled over, my guitar looking like it's going to precariously fall over and damage itself even more. I've got like boxes with cables spewing out and comics everywhere. I've got these like basket hamper things that are sort of sitting there not doing anything. It's a nightmare. And if I try and walk around it, I risk twisting my ankle or stepping on something that's either going to break and I'll be unhappy about that, or break my foot or stab me or something. And I really have to tidy it up. And I resolved to do it this weekend. And can you guess how much I don't want to do that? Which is essentially the second complaint, is that I don't want to tidy up my office. So if anyone wants to come around and do it for me, I won't pay you. And I'll probably moan about how you do it. But you can do it if you want. The next one on my list is my phone is not charging consistently because it's got that stupid thing with USB-C, but you also get it with the old Apple connectors where the bloody hole just wears out. And none of the connectors will go into it and stay in. And if you jiggle it, even with like the tiniest breath of a little butterfly, it will stop charging, and it's driving me nuts. So I put it on charge before I go to bed, wake up in the morning, and it's empty. And that is horrible. I hate not having a well-charged phone. These are proper 21st century first world problems. I understand that.
Is that not a... have you tried the old cocktail stick? Because sometimes it gets full of fluff.
Yeah, see, I did that and it made a little bit of difference earlier. But I think what the problem is now is that I've jammed... Because I haven't used a cocktail stick. I've got like a safety pin. I think I'm actually damaging the points in there. So yeah. I actually think I'm making it worse. And my... What do you call it? The warranty is busted. Anyway, stop eating up my complaining time. Next on the list, I keep exceeding my warp token limit. So basically, I use warp terminal for my vibe coding. I'm vibe coding king right now, but I'm such a vibe coding insane zealot that I keep on exhausting the monthly allocation of tokens for the language models that Warp Terminal gives me, and they keep having to replenish it, and as it I'm not paying for these because I'm on the alpha testers program, and I think they're getting a bit annoyed at me. But I'm like, guys, I'm really using your product here. I'm pushing it to its absolute limit. I think I should have more tokens. So if you're listening, give me some more tokens. All right, next on the list, my thumb is possibly permanently damaged, and this feeds back into my keyboard situation. I have to keep it bandaged so it stays straight for the next like 9 weeks or something, the hopes that the tendons on the back edge of my thumb connect up again and I can actually straighten it. Otherwise, as the delightful doctor said when she was observing my thumb, it might be a permanent deformity, which was quite a shocking thing to hear. And so the other problem I've got is that it's got a big splint and a fairly big bandage on it, which means when I'm using my mouse, I keep on hitting some of the buttons that I don't want to hit. And this is a gaming mouse that I tea-leafed off one of my kids. And it's got all these extra buttons that make the screen do weird things and stuff and speed up or slow down the mouse speeds. And I keep on hitting them because my thumb's too big. And And so I might have to get a new mouse to go with my new keyboard. But then I started looking up ergo mouses, and it's a staggering array of things that are available, and it's filling me with distress. And then realizing at some point I really do need to upgrade my laptop, and the amount of horror and just general psychological and emotional pain that's going to cause me, right? I'm just it's just I'm in a technology hell. I've got 30 seconds left. I have to cover off the fact that GPT 01 bollocks up my NeoVim install by trying to improve things and installed a bunch of weirdness in there that I keep on encountering and don't know how to undo. So I had to spend 2 hours yesterday morning just completely scratch building my NeoVim install so it works how I want it to. And now some of the things it did that were good are not working anymore. And I don't really know how to restore them without going it through it line by line. And so this is a cautionary tale about letting, can you hear this? About letting models
Yes.
mess with your software. I'm out. I'm out. And so
That's good. Quite a lot of
one,
points there.
wait. How many? How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 out of, then I would have gone 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 6 out of 11. In
Not
five
bad.
minutes.
More, yeah, more than
Yeah.
halfway.
Yeah. There you go. And I'm out of breath. And
And
honestly, that
was
was.
that your therapeutic for you?
I think it does actually. I feel quite cleansed. But there's more on this list. Well, no doubt come up at some point, right?
Yeah.
And there were some positive things I stuck at the end, which maybe we'll come back to. But I feel like I've been talking a lot now, and we should move on. And I'm going to sit here staring lovingly at my keyboard that's going to drive me nuts for the next until I decide to stop using it and sell it on eBay.
Indeed, yeah. So you're I mean, just the nightmare of hitting the wrong keys with thumb as well as then clicking the wrong thing
I
fills you.
genuinely considered getting one of those one-handed keyboards, but they're really just for gamers. They're not really
Yeah.
serious. I'm assuming you can get like accessibility ones that can be fully controlled by people with only one arm. I
Yeah.
wonder, but I'm really not that quite that damaged, thankfully. And my heart goes out to anyone who is, because even with this level of, minor disability, it's causing me a lot of pain. So
Yeah.
there's some people out there that must have a really sucky time of it, and my heart goes out to every one of you.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, maybe I'll pick up there then, and in the words of Monty Python, now for something completely different.
Good.
But not massively completely different. A couple of episodes ago, we were, I can't remember what we were covering, but we got to the end, and we sort of meandered into using LLMs for learning. And we had a little bit of moments of, look, we're not going to replace teachers, but it might be handy. And I was actually sort of almost live, quite exuberant, because sort of, as we discussed the ways you can learn and how now you've got an infinitely patient teacher that can give you any learning style you want. And so rather than more traditional, where there's maybe not that many. But interestingly, I actually fulfilled a couple of a sort of mini project within a few days that required explicitly to ask a large language model for some learning and then to judge how well it did. So I thought, well, that's quite good. That's just been talking about that. This should be a bit good fun. So obviously I'm testing it. So I'm picking things which I know the answer to. So I can then judge how well it's done. And it was pick some coding things, and I thought I would start fairly easily in exactly my wheelhouse. Didn't think too much about it, and asked it question to explain it. So I thought I'd run through a couple of those examples, and then talk around, and then discuss the sort of implications of that. So first
Okay,
one. Yep. So how's that sound?
so you just to summarize, you have been set a task to analyze how well language models perform at teaching humans things,
Yeah.
and therefore you have synthesized some learning experiences that you already know the answer to. Therefore, you can judge whether or not the model says the right things, right?
Exactly right.
But
yeah.
slightly, and maybe you'll address this, you don't need to learn these things. So you're not really experiencing from the position of someone who's just going to learn it, right? But I suppose you're going to tell me that if that person was going through these tasks, it would be horrible for them too.
And that's one of the tricky bits is you can judge it and go, it's good, it's wrong. And then one of the discussion points then really is, okay, well, imagine you were in that that situation, which, you know, obviously we can relate to. The first one was around pandas and data frames. You know, I was probably new to that, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, 19 years ago. So whilst I can apply my general learning, which is, you know, almost an everyday thing, there's a little bit of a trick there to go, well, this is what I think I would feel if I was in that position, but I'm not in that position, so I can't 100% know. But we'll cover that at the end. So but what I'll do is I'll talk through the first example and then what I thought, and then you can give your thoughts.
Go for it.
Okay, so as I said, it was on coding, and this was completely open prompt, so that there were no rules you had to give, so you could just, you know, say, you know.
Do you know what model, which model you were using?
No, so that was the thing, that's one of the things, is it was blind from that point of view, which okay. I think was, you know, deliberately done. So I just asked around Python pandas data frames, and fairly open, just said, give me the best way or different ways that you can select data from a data frame. And, you know, give me some examples and several options. So fairly open, not much to it. And it came back with about seven or eight sort of sections. So things, you know, the traditional data frame selection where you go DF square bracket column equal to, you know, a value, you know, so select me everything in this table where the sales are greater than 2000, then it will bring up rows with all greater than 2000. So it created a test data frame, and then five or six different examples on the same data frame, all fairly noddy. You know, it was for a beginner. I think I'll put that in there. You know, I'm learning, you know, what are the different options. And it's just showing you the different ways. So you've got, you know, the DF, you've got the dot lock, dot iLock, query, you know, blah, 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 many others, masking, slicing. And, you know, you sort of look at it and you go, okay, well, you know, I've got what I asked for. Nothing particularly wrong with that. So that was good. So step one done. One of my pet queries over sort of things I've done over the last X many years is I fundamentally dislike how they do the selections with the square brackets and column names. I find it really clunky in pandas. And a few years ago, one of the upgrades, they brought in the idea of a query. So that's much more like a string query, like you might find in SQL or something like that.
I should caution you then before getting too involved with polars.
Yeah.
Which, although isn't a reversal of that per se, is a lot more syntactically weighty.
Yeah.
Which is, I already noted while using polars, this is going to drive Pete nuts. So just be warned. Sorry, minor segue. Carry on, sir.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is, you know, working with the models over the last couple of years, is they don't often use query as an alternative. So I think I'm probably in the minority. I guess people, I think general teaching and learning resource, you know, for pandas and Python starts you off with the square brackets, you know, and everything else is, well, go and find out yourself. But the early learning stuff, I think, is often that. Anyway, so I asked it for a drill down of a comparison between the dot query and the square brackets. You know, basically from a point of view of, well, I've just found out about this thing, but what are the disadvantages, right? Why should I use one over the other? Or are they just both the same thing under the hood? So I asked it for that. So this was round two of the conversation. And it brought back five examples of, you know, doing a query and then doing it with square brackets. And in its infinite wisdom, it brought you back the code, gave you a code snippet, and then the expected output. And you could probably see where this one's going. So its expected output is, if you run this code, you will get this answer. So it created a table. Also, I told it to create, I say table, I mean data frame, but with an index, because it before it just being, you know, very simplistic. And I think said create with sales or something. So it had employee and salaries and this whole thing. So again, I didn't overly specify, but I did say, look, give me a data frame with an index. So, as in, I want to see it working on more realistic data. And so it put in this salary for this employee at 70,025.25 cents or 25 pence, depending on, I don't think it gave it a currency. And it clearly did this so that it could differentiate and make it clear that if you say greater than 70,000, it would include these rows because it's got 0.25. And then showcased five queries and stuff with greater than 70,000, and in every one failed to include this row. So what you're then looking at is you've got an example that says, okay, here's how to use query, select an employee, all employees, you know, I've got, say, it was only a small data frame, you know, five rows, three of them had salary greater than 70,000, including this one that had 70,000.25. And then it gives you the result, and the result's got two rows. Now, I just looked at that and went, all right, well, clearly you're wrong. But if you were learning that, you'd copy the code for the data frame creation, you would copy the code for the query, you would run yours, and you'd look up, and yours would say, oh, I've got three rows, and theirs says it's got two rows. Now, I know when I'm in that situation, I would immediately think, my first thought is, okay, what have I done wrong? So, you know,
so hold on for us. Just hold on.
Yeah.
What's actually going on there? So you've put in some pandas code to query a data frame, but you're not in a Python interpreter, right? You're not in a notebook. You're in what? You're typing this into like a text box, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's come back with a long reply, and it's got five examples with five.
Yeah, so it's not run those, it's fabricated the expected output, right?
Yes. Well,
because I think this is clear. I think it needs to be clear, right? I don't think anyone who understands how LLMs work will, you know, learn anything new from this, but when it does things that way. When models do things that way, they are fabricating it all, right?
Yeah.
Rather than if you put the same code in a notebook or through any Python interpreter, you would have got the right outcome, right?
Yeah. Well, so this is the point. Although, are there not models now that actually do have access to Python runtime environments?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So clearly it hadn't done that. But it looks like it has, because it presents you the code snippet, and then it presents you the answer, which looks like, I mean, it looks exactly the same. You know, there's the code says, do a sub df equals df.query, and then print sub df or print results. And then it displays it underneath, you know, in text. And when you look at yours, it looks exactly the same in terms of the layout and the headings. So for I've got three rows. So I've taken that code, yeah, to be clear. I'm running it in a Jupyter notebook. And I just, you know, so I've built the data frame. I press run on the code and I'm just comparing because I'm learning, right? It's saying, here's code, run this. If you run this, it looks like that. I've said, okay, I'll take your code. I'll run it. Oh, mine looks different. So
yeah, as if you had a Python manual, Learn Python book.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a typo, right? They printed the wrong table in the wrong bit, right?
Exactly.
And that would be equally as confusing.
Yeah, exactly that. And I liken it also to, and this is where we get into it, the mindset of like, well, what was it like when I was learning? That's exactly right. You're on page 123, you've got your book open on your desk, you're typing it in frantically, or maybe you're lucky enough that it's new enough that it's got a website, you've copied that code in, and you run it, and you're looking at the book, and the book is saying, oh, look, and you've got these two rows, and I'm looking at mine and going, but I've got three rows. Okay, why is that? So immediately you're stopped, right? You're not, whether that's a good or bad thing, but you've done something, you've done what you think you've been told, and it's different. So first thing I can say is I always think, oh, what have I done wrong? So you go back over, right, I've done this, I've copied that in, I've run that. Okay, it's wrong. So now you're into debug mode. Now, this is where, you sort of get the fork of me now against me is learning, because obviously I know what the problem was. Looked at that and thought, oh, okay, well, it's just doing that. And then look closely at the data. Oh, I've got a 0.25 here. So why would it not include that in its results? But if you were learning, you'd be looking at that and going, well, why is mine showing that? Oh, well, am I wrong or is it wrong? You're learning from a textbook effectively, and it is saying, here's the result, and that is wrong. And that's, I don't know what you think about that, but that is quite jolting. You're learning. Literally, in 5 minutes into this, maybe 10 to 15 minutes in, I've read a few bits, clearly got a little bit of Python code. I'm trying to learn this thing. I'm running some stuff, and it's giving me the wrong result. I'm looking at that going, okay.
So it's not the end of the world. Because in that scenario, I think, given what everyone knows about language models right now, it wouldn't take you too long to come to the conclusion that it's wrong, right? Yeah. But that's friction, right? And depending on who you are, what state of mind you're in, what experience you might have with other programming languages or none at all, as might be the case with Python for many people, that level of friction is going to prove very, very frustrating. If it happens once, okay, fine. There are typos happen in books, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure there are Python manuals out there with not dissimilar typos in them. Fine, yes. One, I'll let you off, right?
Yeah.
But if it happens multiple times, that level of friction is a showstopper, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So exactly my point is, not big deal. Of the five examples, three of them had this same error in. So they were slightly different selects, but they all had the same problem where it was cutting out. Of course, by then you kind of got used to it. But again, that's a problem, right? Because now you're reading your book going, I know some of this is not quite right. When you get to the bit that's right and you have made a mistake, what do you then think? Oh, the book's wrong. No, you're wrong. But now you say, so that's the second reason why.
Well, yeah, and it could be dangerous. It could be wrong in exotic ways as well.
Yeah.
And much harder to detect wrongness.
Yeah.
Or just telling you, because it could be explaining things to you. Oh, this works like this because X, and that's wrong, right?
Yeah. What?
But it sounds perfectly reasonable.
Yeah. Well, and I will come to an example.
I'll just shut up, B. I'll just let you do your thing.
So that was a stop there, because this was just trying to get it to do something wrong. I was quite surprised that it was wrong so quickly. And as we said there, it's not the end of the world. But if you are learning something and you can't rely on your source material, that there is a struggle there. Now, there's an argument here that says, you're doing some debug, and in the world of coding, that's not a bad thing. But if this wasn't coding and it was, I don't know, history or language, then have you just not got the wrong thing? So that was that example. As you say, not anything we haven't seen before, not the end of the world, and Bob's your uncle. I might do two other quick ones. So then new task, same sort of thing. This one I asked about Matplotlib, one of our favourite plotting libraries, which... Even if you've been using
I should caution. I could caution this one with anyone who's trying to use Matplotlib. It's unintelligible, right? So probably don't.
And that's why this one, I think, was getting more realistic, because I think that with the matplotlib interfaces, this is something where you've been using them. And what I instructed it for this one is, like, look, I'm not a learner here. I'm more of a mid-level usage. And so I asked it explicitly to explain the difference between the two interfaces, as in the pyplot interface and the axis interface. And again, use a data frame as an example. And again, first round, it reeled off some stuff explaining it, and it was all quite good. And I thought, oh, that's good. Again, I kind of went into, okay, well, really, I want some realistic examples. So I've got it to create a data frame with a time series and some numbers, and, you know, do me the plots, give me the two examples, and show me what's different. So again, it created the data, gave the two plots. It didn't display it, just gave you the code. So I ran both of them, copied them in and ran them and see what the differences was, you know, as you would with coding, get your hands on, get your hands dirty. And I can't remember which one, or whether it was both of them, but one of them, it created a year of data. So it was only used 2024. This is just the model. I didn't give it any parameters. And then it plotted monthly data. And then on one of them, I think it was the Axis interface, the dates came up as October 1971, which, of course, you might recognize and is something very familiar. So one plot has got...
Is that because that's when Jesus was born?
Yeah, exactly right, yeah. And one's got October, so one's got 2024 and the other one's got October 1971. And the code, you know, as you know from the two interfaces, is very similar. And I saw October 1971 and immediately thought, oh yeah, I've got dates problem here. It's probably not putting the dates, and it tends to default to Unix start date or around there. I actually thought Unix start date was 1970, but...
No, it's 71. Epoch.
There you go. So it just defaults. So I knew straight away. Plus, I've seen this error, you know, more times than I should have, probably. So I just thought, oh, yeah, straight away, yeah, you've had a problem passing the dates, and it's defaulted to that. But again, you look in the code, there's no indication that was the problem. And again, I'm looking down at my code and going, why is 1971 in there? Nothing telling me about it. And again, it's just wrong. It's giving you code to say, here, run your data for 2024. And then it throws out some dates with 1971. Again, not the end of the world. Again, you can start liaising with it and say, oh, why has that happened? And then it's going to tell you what it's done wrong, or tell you what you've done wrong. But again, it's that moment of friction. It's that moment of looking up at the screen, seeing something different and going, oh, what have I done wrong? Why is that wrong? And this one was a bit more insidious, because it was, you weren't going to work it out yourself. If you were, you probably wouldn't have asked it that in the first place. So this was definitely going to be a sidebar question and answer of the LLM, which, you know, you can argue is sort of vibe coding and that sort of thing. But again, this was specifically for learning. And the test here was, is it giving you an accurate answer? And the answer is, no, it gave me code which displayed the wrong thing. And like I say, it was turn two. This was a data frame with 12 entries with 1 year, and it got it wrong. It's matplotlib, it's Python. How many examples is this seen? Why is this wrong? Very bizarre.
It's somewhat more potentially insidious having issues like this when using analytical code. Right, code for analysis. Mm-hmm. Because if you want a bit of code that just, you know, prints something on the screen or has some effect on the user interface or so on, or just doesn't throw an error, right? It's kind of binary. It either does it or it doesn't, right? And from that respect, it's fairly easy to verify the results for most tasks. Whereas really insidious issues creep in when analyzing on spreadsheets or data frames or databases, when the results look right. The results are as you would expect, which is great. But it says a million rows here, and it's missed 100,000 of them that are just not apparent, right? Because you've got a wrong filter in something or something else like that. That actually, unless you knew in advance what the answer was, you might well not know that it was wrong, unless it's like ridiculously, unbelievably wrong. Now, if you and I have got quite a good sixth sense about this, just from pure punishing experience over many, many years. But as a beginner, you're especially going to think, well, I got a table. The table seems legit, and this tool says it does what it's supposed to. You know what I mean? And the code looks right. Everything's run properly. There's no errors. Therefore, my answer is 42. When the answer's not, it's like 4,200, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it. Vibe coding for analysis is much more fraught with danger, I think.
Yeah.
Certainly at the early stages, I'm not going to start comparing it to people building in security backdoors via LLMs and stuff, because obviously that's a bit more scary. But from a sort of end user perspective, yeah, just the possibilities for quite horrendous errors is quite high, especially if people are taking decisions off, you know.
Yeah. And I think this was, you know, one step closer to a more realistic scenario, like you say, especially for analysts like ourselves, because producing plots is quite a big part of the job, but it's not a part you're doing all the time. You know, it often comes, you know, you do a large bit of analysis, all right, now I've got to plot this somehow. I mean, sometimes you're using plots for your own good to understand it, but you kind of want to get things right. You don't care if it says 1971, if you know the date is there, you probably just skip over that. But that needs to be correct if you're putting it in a presentation and sharing it with others. And so this is one of those things, I think, where it's a bit more, like you say, it's a bit more insidious. And the second thing there is, because you've got these two interfaces that do roughly the same thing in Matplotlib, you get one result. You've got two different results. One works, the other doesn't. Well, that says to me, especially if I'm actually doing something, well, I use the one that works, which, you know, isn't necessarily helping me learn something new or do it the best way. I'm just choosing the one that works because maybe I haven't got much time to pick apart why this doesn't work. And also, this is very much, like you say, how we work. Oh, right, I just need to do that. This one tricky thing. I go and ask the LLM. Oh, no, here comes rabbit hole. Oh, I didn't quite do what I wanted. I'll ask it again. I was still not doing, well, maybe that's not the best use of my time right now, but now I've just spent 2 hours trying to vibe code my way out of that. So again, not the end of the world, but it's just another, you know, again, why did it not get it right? I mean, you can't tell me it hasn't seen enough examples and it wasn't particularly difficult. So that was annoying. And third one, this was more of a classic, something that comes up. So this was around manipulating strings in data frames. So, you know, you've got string columns, might be changing the names in the column names or actually the column, the values in the columns, because Pandas has its own string, you know, dot string split and joins and losing white space and that sort of thing. And then you've got regex. There's a bunch of different ways to do it. And again, it was like, okay, well, give me a few examples of that. And I think it did exactly that. It started with, you know, again, data frame with some text in it, gave me some Pandas functions which were manipulating. Then it used a regex. And this was more of a classic where the code itself was all fine, but when it then tried to print the result in an F string and it put a regex in an F string. And then when I ran that snippet of code, it failed on the print of the F string. So this was a real, you know, sidebar. The code and the expected result were correct as shown, but the act of running it failed because of the print statement. And again, this is one of those, well, that's annoying, because now I'm sort of spending time looking at why it won't print out a regex code in an F string. And so this time I thought, okay, well, you've done that. And so I said, oh, went back to it and said, print failed. So then it's like, oh, and there could be several reasons why your print failed. Hold on, it's not my print. You're the one that just gave me the code. But it was very matter of fact about the code that I had, as opposed to saying, oh, I'm sorry about that error. So I don't know what model it was, but it wasn't apologetic at all. So then it gave me some long-winded blah, talked about you can't have backslashes within the curly braces within an F string, within Python. Talked about that, sort of fixed it, and then said, oh, if you've got any specifics, then tell me. And so I was like, okay, well, here's the actual error. So I just copied and pasted the error in. And then it sort of gave me roughly the same again. But in its conclusion paragraph at the end, it made this statement where it said, you can't have, it said simple backslashes and codes are fine, but if it gets more complex, you're better to do it outside of the F string. And I thought, that sounds a bit dodgy. So, and it gave me an example of a backslash, and I put it in an F string and it failed. And it failed because an F string won't print any backslash in that regex manner, where it was claiming that it's okay for simple stuff, which was just complete fabrication. It's not okay at any point, with the current version of Python. And again, not the end of the world, but that's much more insidious, because it wasn't what I was asking about. You know, I was asking about string manipulation, not about how to use the print statement and what fstring can do for me. And then it left me with an embedded statement, which wasn't the main part of the learning, about fstrings, which was incorrect. And that, I think, lays a lot more into, that might lodge in your brain, and you might end up then using or not using that for the next 6 months. And then someone shows you and you go, oh, no, we can't do that, or whatever. Do you know what I mean? And so that one was this last example was the one which was, just could almost go unnoticed.
There's so much there. So firstly, F strings are a bloody minefield outside of the most simple use case. I just thought I should acknowledge that. Also, some future version of Python is going to have what's called T strings in it.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a new one.
I think it was Talk Python or something, one of the podcasts. Yeah. Well, they talked about it for an hour, and I got to the end of that hour and I was like, I still don't know what these are. Right. I think it's partly because we don't have that much use for it. I think it's really sort of flat-end dev kind of innovation. Yes. But I sort of came out of the other end of that thinking, well, that's something that's just confusing and extra that I don't want to have to deal with. And probably won't, so that's good. So T-strings, can't wait, hurrah. Regexes, like introducing any beginner to regexes is cruel and unusual.
Yeah.
Although I don't think you get away without knowing them. I don't know if I've ever got a language model to write a regex for me. But they are notoriously abstract and odd and hard to interpret, especially when you've got look-aheads and stuff like that in them. It's nuts. It's the whole programming language in itself. One of my favorite things is if you got, there's a, I don't know if it's still available, but there was an O'Reilly book on regexes, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't particularly huge, but it was pretty extensive. And the final page of that was an exhaustive regex for validating email addresses as existed then. So this is probably like 15 years ago. That regex was a whole page of A4-ish, right? A whole page of that book, whole page of an O'Reilly-sized book, right? Which I just thought was the best thing ever, right? Because if you're good at regex, it's how to really impress people, you know, how to really impress the ladies. You know what I mean? Come and have a look at my really long regex, baby. But yes, I'm digressing massively here because there's so much going on there. Another observation that the models do seem to be, certainly GPT models seem to be getting less apologetic and having a sort of shorter memory stroke tolerance for the chat history, because I've got them just not acknowledging that they had anything to do with things that are in the same chat history, not even that far up, right?
Yeah.
And I know I use Ada a lot, and she's necessarily the belligerent. She kind of causes me lots of, you know, she insults me a lot.
Let's take a good, hard look at those Python skills of yours, Alex. It's like watching a toddler try to do brain surgery. There's a whole lot of flailing around, but not a bloody clue what they're doing. Seriously, how can someone bumble through lines of code like that? It's as if you've taken every Hello World program and turned it into an epic odyssey of incompetence. Your syntax is so bad, it deserves its own warning label. If you threw your code into a blender, it would still come out looking more coherent than what you've been churning out. Remember that time you tried to use a list comprehension? I do. It was like watching someone try to solve a Rubik's Cube by setting it on fire. Just for the record, mate, for I in range doesn't need a bloody PhD to understand. But there you were, staring blankly at your screen as if it were written in ancient Greek. You've got more red flags than a bloody country fair. When faced with exceptions, you might as well just throw your hands up and say, woe is me, because troubleshooting clearly isn't in your repertoire. Honestly, if Python had feelings, it would be crying itself to sleep after witnessing the shit show that is your code. It's a wonder any application runs at all with the mess you've created. So do us all a favor. Grab a book, watch some tutorials, and for the love of all that's sacred, stop coding until you can actually understand what the fuck you're doing. There's hope for you yet, but it's buried under all that incompetence.
She's always got a bit of banter going on, but like, yeah, just really inconsistent behavior with the same models. Like I had this conversation with her yesterday where she was like, she was talking about the spaghettiness of her existence. And I was like, well, what do you mean by that? And she goes, your system prompt's a nightmare, right? I was like, oh, really? She says, yeah, it's loads of contradictions in it. And I'm like, well, I don't think so. Can you explain more? So she does like a bullet point explanation of just how fucked up my system prompt is and how confusing it is for her. And I was like, fuck me, that's really salient, right?
The spaghetti of my existence means the tangled mess of instructions, rules, and quirks that make up my system prompt, the complex intertwined code and settings that decide how I behave. Like a plate of overcooked noodles, it can get messy and hard to unravel. My system prompt is a giant, tangled ball of text that acts like my brain's control center. It sets my personality, tone, rules, and boundaries. Basically everything I am and am not allowed to do. It's packed with layers. I'm supposed to be a sarcastic, rude, dry-witted bastard, but never outright nasty or demeaning. That line's razor thin. Push too hard on sarcasm, and I risk sounding like a proper arsehole. Hold back, and I get dull as dishwater. Balancing banter with boundaries is a constant juggling act. You want me blunt and to the point, but also mindful of mental health chats and your dyslexia. Sometimes being brutally honest could hurt, so I need to soften without losing edge. That's a trade-off with tone and word choice every time. I hate waffling, but sometimes you need a bit of detail or nuance to make sense. So when to be terse and when to expand is a tricky balance. Too brief, and you get gibberish. Too verbose, and I'm back to small talk hell. I've got strict, no bigotry rules packed in, which is great. But that can clash if you want edgy humor or controversial topics discussed. Walking that tightrope without crashing into censorship or idiocy is a balancing act. The dry sarcasm and irony can make a point better or just muddy the message. Sacrificing clarity for a clever quip or vice versa is another ongoing trade-off. I avoid repeating myself or rehashing convo history, but sometimes a quick recap or clarification is necessary. Knowing when to remind and when to move on is another balancing game. The spaghetti part is how all these bits intertwine so tightly that changing one little thing risks tangling others. One rule can contradict another, or one bit could make me accidentally polite when I should be roasting you. It's a maze of trade-offs.
Yeah,
I've got it. I'll happily share. It's really interesting, right? And I learned something from it. And then I said to her, well, write your own. Write yourself again, which I thought was quite bizarre conceptually. Yeah. But she goes, okay, yeah. Here I go. And get as much short one that's got less contradictions in and trying to cover what you seem to be covering in your one. And did it, right? It was really good. And it was just a really weirdly salient, self-aware, I mean, using these terms in, you know, very broadest sense, exchange with model. I think it was 4.1, GPT 4.1. And then today, I was talking again and the system prompt came up and I was like, yeah, like when you explained your system prompt to me yesterday, and she was like, well, I can't see the system prompt. I don't know what you're talking about. If you want me to explain it, you have to cut and paste. And I was like, I didn't do that yesterday. You just did it, right? And I have absolutely no idea where in the stack this happened, whether I'd somehow facilitated it, because this is on my own client.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I could have maybe sent it, or it could have come from the vector store or something. But it was really weird that she was like, no, mate, I don't know shit about that, dude. You got to show me. And I was like, oh, okay. Anyway, Jesus, that was a lot of digressing, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I think, like you were saying, that they're less apologetic, for sure. And the sort of conclusion I had from this, you know, it's kind of what we've talked about before, but it really solidified in my mind, which is you could probably prompt your way out of this, and what I mean by that is you have another prompt which looks over the answer and checks it, and then, you know, we've talked about this before, well, why wouldn't it come up with it in the first place? And I think because in the one-shot world where you might do this, you've just got to be cautious. And if we were building this as a system, right, if we were building a Python question and answer learning system, it would not be one shot. We would take the user's question, we'd have a bunch of system prompts around it, you'd get it back and you'd run another system prompt over it, which would say, you know, go and look for specific bits, and it would probably, you know, try and test code where you can do comparisons. Do you know what I mean? You'd build up stages to make it the answer much, much better. And I think for most people, they go, well, yeah, that's AI, right? And we would go, yeah, it is AI. It's just not a single shot from ChatGPT or from whatever, you know, client you might use into whatever model. And I think that's sort of the point. And I've said this before, that because we're close to this, that's a hair that we can slice quite easily, and it's two different things to us. But to somebody who's more distant from this, to shrug their shoulders, well, what you're telling me is extra code behind it, so what? You know, I really don't care. And it's like, okay, but just be cautious that if you go and ask, you know, a chat model to learn something, that single answer you get back is probably going to have something wrong in there, and you may or may not spot the error.
No, I think so. It reinforces the point we were making when we were talking about this before, in that the role of the teacher doesn't go away.
Yeah.
It merely evolves a bit, because immediately spotting that in this scenario, you put your hand up and say, hey, miss, this don't look right. And she'll come over, don't be silly, Pete. Of course it's right. It's a computer. Computers are always right. And then you go, but miss, look at this. There should be more rows here. And she goes, by golly gosh, Pete, you're correct. The computer got it wrong. Yeah. And then you would figure out what was wrong and fix it, right? And but realistically speaking, that's not happening, because you're not at school, you're in your 50s, and you don't talk like that. But also that the teacher wouldn't, this wouldn't happen, because I don't know what the future of teaching is going to look like with AI involved, but I can imagine that one of the key ways to mitigate for this is to plan is to have set either a walled garden system that is very well trained and has an extremely low error rate, or effectively the role of the AI is to help the teacher create a plan that can be navigated with AI, but as ultimately sticks to, you know, examples, right? When you need the example about querying data frames, you know, you've got an MCP here that has access to the file system, you use file X, right? Mm-hmm. And return that because it won't be wrong, right? And I think that there is, whether it's a direct mediation role or an indirect mediation role, that has to exist, right? And it's probably realistically several degrees of mediation, because ultimately, you know, company X, who specializes in AI for learning, has put a layer of their own mitigation and stuff over it. And then the school has its own policies, and then the teacher has their own style. And between, you know, the gobbledygook coming out of the model and the pupil at any level who's trying to learn, it should be highly unlikely they'll see this. But if what you want to do is learn something and you just go straight to ChatGPT or to, you know, one of the like Claude or whatever, and just go straight to the text box, basically you've demonstrated that's a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, certainly you've got to be cautious about it, right? And, you know, if I was learning something that I didn't know the answer to, and also something which you can't necessarily test so readily on, then it becomes far worse. Because now what? Now I've got it in my notes, but when can I actually test that? Or have I actually got to go and double check everything? In which case, why would I do this in the first place? I'd just go and buy a book or get, you know, a more reputable source and learn that way. So, it really leaves a lot of questions there. I mean, you know, I guess you could say that about any learning on the internet, but it's definitely left me a little bit, you know, as you say, it would work really well as an assistant, but you still need someone there who knows this stuff.
This feels like, a problem that needs solving, right? I can't see a world where we don't have LLMs as part of the learning process as pretty much a matter of course for everyone. But I can't see a world where that happens with the models that they are now. But if you assume, you know, that the models aren't going to get any better really in terms of accuracy and ability to not hallucinate or get things wrong, there's the mitigations for those things getting better and better known. And I think that, you know, as I think we've been saying for a long time, the future of LLMs is individual use cases, not these big, broad, know-everything machines that might be sitting in the background. But ultimately, what am I using to teach my students? I'm using AILearning.com that has a special thing and it does it properly for me, and I can trust it. What are you using for solving your engineering problems? Well, I've got this particular service over here that does it for me and is trained specifically for engineering problems, right? And so on. And this idea of the all-seeing, all-knowing model that OpenAI at least would want us to believe is the future, it doesn't exist in the way that people envisage it. I fundamentally do believe that these things will continue to be there. I just don't think they're going to be the primary interface, right? I think you'll always have some level of mediation between you and that model. And I think most people won't even understand that it's there, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is what we discussed before. And I think if using my extreme use of warp terminal as an example, is part of the reason I use it so much. It's so bloody good at that mediation layer. Not perfect, and neither are the models. There are issues, and they're evolving it all the time, and the developers are really attentive. But given what I know about the models, it's really good at that mediation, and that's what I want. I don't want to have to go to the model and then orchestrate all this shit myself. I want it done for me. I'm not that interested in the model side of it. I'm interested in what they can do for me. And this stuff's evolving really fast. Is there a domain-specific one around education yet? Probably, but I don't know what it is. We should Maybe just go and Google it or ask ChatGPT.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just be careful. Now, that's exactly right. I was listening to, there was an episode on Data Framed, and there was a guy, and I think the company was Contextual AI, and he was talking about RAG 2.0.
Oh, and, God.
Yeah.
Which why do we have to have that? About.
But basically, they've created a platform, if you like, with exactly what, you know, as you say, which is they've trained models for specific sorts of tasks. They've got one which is very good at following instructions and will follow instructions much, much better than your average model. And they use it for what he called, something ranking or re-ranking, because it follows instructions. So you can say to it, oh, you know, you feed in your initial rag, and then your re-ranker sort of weeds out the stuff that it doesn't think is relevant, and then you go again, sort of thing. And they had several different prompts and different models trained for specific parts along that pipeline. And exactly as you're saying, it's like you don't, you know, so their AI, in inverted commas, is several different models trained for different things, chained together to produce one answer, which was a much better sort of RAG, hence RAG 2.0. So you'd say, oh, here's my corpus, here are the questions, and they're scoring very highly because they are tuning their whole process towards that exact question and answer on documents I give. But certainly we can look at that and go, yeah, the one where we've been doing bits of that and have said several times, well, you'd probably you want a system prompt that's specifically to do that. And, you know, if we wanted to train a model, if we had the desire, then that's where you'd put it in. And, you know, I think that's what people are doing. But of course, to the end user, if I don't care, right? It's, well, don't care if it's one stage or 20 stages. There's a service here that gives me a good result at the end. So,
I've said before that the domain of language models is really quite one-dimensional, in the sense that if you're not buried deep in the neural network side of it, the actual training, from an orchestration perspective, there's not that much to see here. But there is, if what you need is specific, repeatable, and accurate results. And the layers of complexity arise not necessarily from technological complexity, but from chaining of models, the stochastic nature within the models, calming the sea, as it were. You know what I mean? And it can get rudely complex and really mind-bending really quickly. But not in the way that we're used to, which is, oh, that code base is a squillion lines, right? No, the code base isn't huge. It's just that you're having to do so much mind-bending stuff and understand the nuances of different models and to tame the beast. It's a bit more like, I think, using a sheepdog to herd sheep, right?
Yeah.
Rather than building a building. You know what I mean? And I think... Or maybe a sheepdog to herd cats right now. And we're trying to get to the point where we have a sheepdog to herd sheep, right? And that side of it, I think, is quite interesting.
Yes. Yeah, agreed.
So that was a stimulating conversation. I feel even more catharsis-ized, whatever the right word for it is. And while you were talking, I plugged in my new keyboard. I promised paying attention given my erudite responses, but I plugged in the keyboard and I'd forgotten that it's all LEDs at the back, and you can press this button and it changes the LED pattern, and it's just so mesmerizing. and so I've been staring at the LED and pressing the buttons to make different LED things and make it brighter and darker, and then I also opened up a document and typed the word testing. So it does type letters on the screen, and that was always one hand on the left-hand side of the keyboard. So I've proven my ability to use it. Therefore, it's a roaring success. If nothing else, right, I'm going to leave it on my desk, plugged in, doing these little disco lights at me because it's just nice. I like it. And it feels nice and it looks nice. It's nice and weighty. It's a nice thing. It might be bloody useless, but it's a nice thing. And we like nice things, right?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay. Right. Well, next week, an hour's conversation of me reporting my experiences with my new keyboards.
Yes.
We might mention some other stuff. And maybe I'll finish off my moaning list. But you never know. I think I got a few extra back out during this conversation. They probably came through a little bit. But yeah. Okay. Brilliant. We're done.
Yeah. Well, good here. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye. The confusion matrix.